Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, what do you do when your elected officials refuse to touch an issue? Well, in many parts of the country, you can turn to your neighbors. Citizens have direct ballot access, and our guest today has helped people use it. And so we are joined by Scott Tillman, the Chief Operating Officer at U.S. Term Limits. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me, James.
Tell us, what do you do?
Well, with U.S. Term Limits, we're trying to, first and foremost, put term limits on U.S. Congress. It's supported by over 80% of people across the country, bipartisan support. It's, when you get into independents, it's even higher. But among both parties, it's 75 to 85%. It's just huge numbers. Congressmen will go out there and talk in favor of it. You would think, how could we not have this? It's got such overwhelming support. But then when it gets to the rubber hits the road, they find excuses. They don't like this term. They don't like that term. They find every reason in the world not to do it. And that's because of all the reasons we need it. It's a very cushy, you know, position that gives a lot of prestige and a lot of opportunities to enrich yourself and enrich your friends and enrich your contacts. Power. They don't want to give up that power. So we're working on term limiting them. And to do that, there's two different ways to amend the Constitution. And that's our big project, is term limiting Congress. And we have several different ways that we're bringing the leverage to Congress, trying to move that Overton window so that Congress will be receptive to the idea, where right now we know the public is, but getting, you know, that window moved for Congress is a huge step. And there's ways that we go about attacking it.
So that changing the U.S. Constitution is a huge policy proposal. I mean, it is massive. It has only happened a couple of times. It's been a very long time since the United States has changed its Constitution. So what does it entail? Like, what's your strategy?
Well, to change the Constitution, you have to get a constitutional amendment proposed. And there's two ways. In Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, there's two ways to do it. Congress can suggest out an amendment. It requires two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate, which is a big lift. It's like supermajority.
And that's really tough in this case, because this is the example that, or this is an institution where our elected officials have political reasons not to do this, political and personal reasons not to do this, even if it's popular. So that's a tough.
Very, very big lift. Mm-hmm. And the second way is for states to say, we want this. And then the way it's written into the Constitution is that when two-thirds of the states ask for an amendment convention, then Congress is bound to call it. But the way that has historically worked is when the number of states asking for a specific thing get up there, Congress all of a sudden realizes that, oh, this will be taken from us and we won't have control over this situation unless we jump out in front and do it ourselves. So we anticipate Congress preempting that. We call it preemption. They've done it in many ways. You know, when the direct election of senators, the 17th Amendment, the repeal of prohibition, you know, states were moving this way and Congress is like, well, it's in our interest to get in front of this. So we anticipate as we get close to 34 is the number that's required. As we get close to 30 or 32 states passing resolutions, that Congress will say, whoa, 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 this is such a great idea. What we're going to do is we're going to grandfather everybody here, so that we all wouldn't have to, but everybody who comes after us, they'll have to have term limits, which we're fine with. We need to get the ball rolling on it. So we're working around. We passed 9 states. We passed 4 states last year. 9 states have passed these resolutions to call for a term limits amendment. And then we also have another program that we work on where, you know, if you go to a congressman and ask them, hey, jump on for term limits, very, 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 very difficult to get them. But if you go to a candidate who's running for Congress, either against a seated congressman or in most cases an open seat, you say, hey, term limits for Congress, right off the bat, most of them are regular people or close enough to regular people that they will sign on. But a lot of them, when you show them, hey, look, this is an 80% issue across the board, both sides want this, you can go out there, it's popular, bring it up at some of your events, and you're going to see that it gets an applause line every single time. Then we get them to sign our pledge. The pledge is for a very specific amendment, because we had a situation back in 1995 where Newt Gingrich and the Republicans with the contract with America, they pulled a fast one. They said they were going to have a vote on term limits. They did have a vote on term limits, but they did it in an underhanded way where they actually had 3 votes on term limits with different amounts so that they knew that none of them would actually get to the two-thirds required. So now we have a very specific thing. We're increasing our number of congressional, Congress members who are signers on that pledge every cycle. Last cycle we had, at the end of session, there was 111 co-sponsors in the House and 21 co-sponsors and co-sponsors in the Senate. This year we've got about 10% more in the House and in the Senate who will be on, although we're right at the start. You know, things were just introduced last week, so we obviously have to whip them up and make sure that they get on the bill. So we're not up to that number yet, but we've got over 150 members in both houses that are pledged to support, you know, our term limits amendment.
So I think I want to make explicit something that I think is a clever part of your strategy, which is you've stated that once you're in office, there are zero incentives to pass term limits. It is all cost and no benefit. And so it's really tough to get the people who are already elected to do anything about term limits. And with this kind of proposal that you've got, you can either do it through Congress, you can do it through states, and even through state legislators. That's kind of a separate thing. But to get Congress to try and pass it, to get them more conducive, you actually have to talk to them when they're candidates, where there are benefits, where there are political benefits to endorsing term limits. And then you also have to bind them to something. So you have an actual pledge that says, no, this is exactly what you said. When push comes to shove, if we get enough people, you've got to be on the side. Otherwise, you have misled your own voters. So I think that's a clever strategy, and it's a way of leveraging political incentives around this issue.
Yeah, you really do have to lock them down on it. You got to get it in writing. You got to get them committed on it. Social media has really allowed a lot of opportunities where once we get them in writing, once we get them, you know, on the record on it, then you can go out there and not so much, although we do go after them when they break their pledges or do bad things. But if you're out there in front of it and you're praising them for the good thing and you're getting them attention on being in favor of the good thing, it makes it a lot harder for them to backpedal and to weasel out of it. Which, you know, people, when you talk about weaseling out of things, politicians, they come to mind. You know, that's a lot of stuff they do is weaseling out of things that they've said in the past or coming up with excuses why they can't produce it.
And it's just also basic political calculus. It's like you have to give them benefits too. Like they're people like everyone else. They're responding to rewards and demerits like everyone else. And so it's smart to try and figure out ways to make sure that they benefit from endorsing your policy proposals.
Yeah, the biggest thing when we talk to candidates, especially for state legislatures, they'll always come up with an excuse of, well, term limits aren't the issue. The issue is gerrymandering, or the issue is money in politics. And it's important when you talk about term limits to understand why term limits are important. And this, you know, we want fair elections. And I have yet to talk to anybody who thinks that we shouldn't have fair elections. I know that there's a couple that I've talked to that have lied to me and told me the thing. But for the most part, that's a universal agreement that it's important that elections be fair. And to have fair elections, you've got, it's my three-legged stool when I explain it to people. You have to have a regular open seat because there is a distinct advantage to being incumbent. And we can look at Congress, we can look at state legislatures, you can look at city council. Being the incumbent gives you big, big advantages. It gives you fundraising advantages with people that you go out and ask for campaign donations. It gives your opponent a disadvantage because people don't want to donate to the guy who is running against the guy and be known later that you oppose this candidate. It gives you advantages when you try to get an op-ed published in your local media. If you call up the local TV station and want to come out and talk about an issue and you're some guy who's challenging the congressman versus if you are the congressman can get on pretty easy. Radio shows, same thing. You get name recognition, you get a lot of things. There's huge, huge incumbent advantages. The only way that we can get away from and have a fair election without incumbent advantage is term limits, to have that open on a regular basis. The other two legs of that stool are gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is where a party sets the districts, and they set it in such a way that the party will maintain majority. So we see this a lot in state legislatures, but also you see it in Congress because of what state legislatures are doing. They draw the maps in such a way to compact your opposing party's voters into a smaller district or into more into one district, and then you spread it out. And that's a pretty big deal. And yes, that is a fair elections issue. Term limits doesn't deal with that issue. Money in politics doesn't deal with that issue. It's a it's something that you need to have some other way to deal with. In Michigan, a few years ago, they passed a Citizens Redistricting Commission. Now, anytime those are passed, they're going to have certain biases and they're going to be played in certain ways. But that was the purpose of it and why it was done. The third issue when it comes to fair elections is money and politics. And when you want to talk about money and politics, a lot of people think we need to regulate, we need publicly funded elections. It's money in politics is directly related to the size of the district. If you want to decrease influence of money in politics, make the district smaller so that each elected politician is more responsive to a smaller number of voters. And you can look at this. It's easily demonstrable. You look at the Vermont and New Hampshire legislatures, very, very small districts, North Dakota, Wyoming, very small districts, and you can beat incumbents easily there. The same point, somebody can raise $1 million and run for state house in New Hampshire. And somebody can raise $100 and buy palm cards off Vistaprint. And that person who raises $100 can beat that person who raised $1 million just because they go out and hand out those palm cards. They talk to those people.
Sorry, palm cards?
Palm cards, little cards that say what your campaign is about.
Okay, gotcha.
They can beat the guy who goes out and runs $1 million in TV because you're talking to, 4,000 voters. And you can go out and talk to 4,000 voters three times an election cycle. And your mom can get everybody in your district on the phone in 2 weeks and tell them about what a great kid you are and go out and you can beat that.
So you're a big expand the house kind of guy.
I'm a big expand the house kind of guy. If you want fair elections, if you want to solve the money in politics issue, money in politics is all about district size. And anybody who tells you need to do something else, either they haven't looked at that or they have some other nefarious purpose for pushing what they're pushing. And you can look at places like Los Angeles County, California, where the districts, each elected representative represents more than a person in Congress. And they cost tens of millions of dollars to run to win there. It's almost impossible to win a seat there. And they're representative of the people who give them the money. And that's what we have in Congress now. So, yeah. But if you want fair elections, those three issues, gerrymandering, incumbent advantage, and money in politics, the solutions to each don't solve the other two issues. If you fix gerrymandering, it does nothing for money in politics. It does nothing for incumbent advantage. If you solve the money in politics issue, it does nothing about gerrymandering and does nothing about incumbent advantage. And if you put in term limits, it won't solve the other two. So we're working on one specific leg of that stool. It's a very important leg. And for the most part, any solutions to these three problems, almost any good solutions that are real solutions rather than just politicians shoring up their own power, have to come through the citizen initiative process. And this is where voters can, and it's not applicable in every state, but there's a few states, about half the states, where you have some level of, you can go out and do things independent of your legislature. You can introduce legislation, draft things by taking around petitions, get people to sign the petition, other voters like you, and then it will appear on the ballot. And I've been very involved with this, because I was involved in term limits, and then I've helped a lot of people out through this and been very involved with it over the years.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the opposition to term limits, because it seems like the biggest opposition is not people arguing that that House members and or congressmen should have open terms. It's simply apathy. This issue goes away if we don't talk about it. No one can force us to take a vote on it. And so that's why the initiative process seems like it's the appropriate strategy, because in the initiative and referendum or citizen access to the ballot mean that our lawmakers our lawmakers who have an incentive not to touch this issue cannot avoid it anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we tried using the citizen initiative back in the 90s. There was 22 states that tried to limit their own congressional delegation, and it was very, very popular. And then there was a Supreme Court case in 1995, U.S. term limits v. Thornton, Thornton being a congressman from Arkansas. And the Supreme Court had a 5-4 decision that said it has to apply to everybody. You can't go state by state and limit. And that really took a lot of wind out of the sails of the term limits movement. And that's why now we decided about 14 years ago to come back and start pushing in state legislatures as using that as another way around. State legislators are also kind of self-interested, and they think, and they see that if we can put term limits on Congress, that will open up opportunities for us to move up into more prestigious seats in Congress.
How'd you get 9 states?
So we started, Florida has always been like the core not always, but in the last 20 years has been like the core of where we have our biggest support. And a lot of it is because our president and a lot of our board members reside in Florida. And Florida has just been very, very vocal on term limits and done a lot. We have several congressmen from Florida. So we were able to, the first state we passed was Florida. So we put that, we got Florida passed. And then we started going from there. And we anticipated that if we, you know, went into state legislatures, you know, worked with some lobbyists, that maybe we could just, you know, put these, you know, get these passed. But it turns out that state legislators have a bristle. They don't like the idea of term limits either. And you have to break through that. And our first approach there to just go in and lobby and get it passed did not work. So I hear a lot from people who oppose term limits, well, term limits give the lobbyists power and the lobbyists would love to have term limits. No, the lobbyists are right there with the politicians that are opposing us on this. And when we go in any state and work on term limits, it's always the lobbyists and the politicians that are working against us. What we ended up, what we're having success with is we go state by state. We approach people who are candidates. We approach them when they're candidates and when they're running for office, and we get them to pledge support. And that's really important, getting them to put it down in writing, and then we go out there and we let people know far and wide all about how they're in favor of this. And then we're able to get in, show leadership, you know, the people who are allowing bills to come to be heard and things like that. Look at, here's our list, because you got all these pledgers, here's our list of people who are, you know, on the whip list, people who are going to co-sponsor this. This can pass. You can be in front of it. It can look really good for you, and you're giving something to the people that they want. And we started putting wins up on the board by going through like that and going in and doing the networking, getting the pledges, and then going on the ground, getting activists to help. And then, you know, we have our own team that goes around and does lobbying in the states and work to pass these things. And it's been a slog. Now we're hitting, you know, we passed four last year. I mean, it was from 12 for over 13 years ago to, you know, and we had, I think it was 4 years before we passed the next one in Alabama. And then it's been a few years, and then now they're getting where they're coming quicker. So
I assume that getting people to sign those pledges while they're running for office is probably the key, because that at that point, it just takes time for the people who already in office to get out of office, the people who are coming in office who you've approached to sign these pledges to get in before you get a majority of them so that you can enact this type of legislation.
Yeah, with politicians, you got to get it in writing. And what that pledge does is get it in writing. And if you're out there and you have a movement for something, you know, talk to candidates and get them to, you know, a pledge is great. And they get advised not to do pledges. Mm-hmm. But if you're a candidate, you put something down in writing and your opponent's not willing to, then you can point to that and it will separate you from the others. And that resonates with people. There's a lot of people who think, oh, a politician's lips are moving, he's lying. And there's a reason for that. I mean, they've got a reputation. But if you put things in writing, it matters to people. And being able to see that and point to that, and for you as a candidate, as well as for people to say, look, this is the guy that I support. Well, why should I support him? He's actually putting it in writing and making a promise to do what he's saying. He's not just going up there and giving a campaign speech where he talks fluff about this or fluff about that.
So I wanted to summarize this term limits issue and see if I got it, because I think there's some major strategic and important points that they're worth making explicit for our audience. Term limits is a thing that Congress is never going to pass. There's just zero political incentives. It's all cost, no benefits. So in order to get something, there has to be a statewide effort. There's the way to convince states to do this is because they face the same political advantages. But when you're running for office as a fresh candidate, endorsing term limits has some political benefits. You're trying to emphasize those. You're trying to deliver those. Get them to sign pledges so that they can't back away from this. So that when they're in office, you go state by state, get a majority of them to endorse this, so that you can the states can pass these requirements. And once you get enough states, then Congress is going to be forced to act. So it's a way around a tricky situation where Congress is simply not going to act. But I want to go back to something that you mentioned I mentioned earlier, which is part of your efforts to get local ballot access, you're helping a lot of local groups with their own proposals outside of term limits. What are some of those?
Yeah, over the years, I've helped a lot of people with a lot of different local proposals. Most recently, there's a group up in North Dakota that did age limits on their congressional members. And that was a statewide initiative. But locally, I've helped people with pension reform issues. We've helped people with civil asset forfeiture reform issues. One that was one that I came up with, and we took. So in, if everybody remembers the issue in Ferguson, Missouri, several years ago, where there was a man killed by a police officer, and then there was an investigation. But leading up to the investigation, there were a lot of riots and everything because there was no documentation on what had happened. So we there was a group down there that wanted to do something about that. And we actually wrote a charter amendment for the city of Ferguson that would require them to require their police force to use body cameras. We kind of outlined how that would be accessed and things like that. In other places, we've done civil asset forfeiture, which I mentioned, a couple of cities in Michigan, we did that. You know, if the city is going to be taking property, there should not be a perverse incentive where they have, you know, they can take the money and then just the local department use it for things. It should have to go into at least a general fund and have some oversight and just take that out of it. And there's many, many different things that people have done. Other groups have done ethics reform. I'm talking to some people right now about different ethics reforms in different places, which normally comes down to transparency, disclosure, and, you know, that you want to be able to get access to the public records in a timely fashion and without huge expenses, which Mackinac knows all about. But then also that they're actually bound to give it to you and that they can't just worm out of it. A lot of places have ethics reform on the books, but there's no teeth to it. And you really can't get it. You can go through expensive court battles and you never get any, you know, compensation for the money that you've had to spend. So it's there's a lot of different things. But legislators, they don't want to pass these things. City councils, they don't want to pass these things. So sometimes you got to come in and you got to pass it on your own. And that means that, you know, you've got to draft legislation. You've got to figure out who you can hire to help you get the petitioning done. You got to figure out the deadlines, and everything like that. Well, I've done a lot of that over the years. So people call me up. I'm able to say, well, as we're looking at this, probably going to need a lawyer. But before you go spend thousands of dollars on a lawyer, asking the lawyer who's never done anything like this before to draft this up, let's look and see what else has been done in other places. Let's find something. What don't we like about this one that was done in this city? What should we change about it? And then once we get it in almost ready format, we'll take it to a lawyer, you know, run your eyes over this, tell us what we're going wrong. And we find another lawyer who's a whole different law specialty who deals with drafting petitions, putting it in the right format. We figure out what the process is, what you got to do for disclosure, you know, your own campaign finance reporting. Then, you know, I'm going to go door to door, but my gosh, this is thousands of signatures. I don't have enough time in the 6 months that they allow me to do this to go and get all these signatures. How can I get this done? Well, there are people out there who go and professionally do this. Well, there's some that you don't want to deal with, and there's some that you could want to deal with. So I,
which has been an issue in the state of Michigan with people hiring.
Issue in the state of Michigan. So I've done enough of this that I can advise and help people out with that, which means that I get called a lot to help with those things. And I'm a big believer in the initiative process. So I do help people. Right.
So that is a massive, like a wide ranging array of issues that you've been working on. Like, how do people know to call you?
Well, there's a group out there called Citizens in Charge Foundation, and they have a sister organization, Liberty Initiative Fund, and they're run by Paul Jacob, and I used to be their national field director. And so if you get looking at the initiative process and you're looking at, you know, if you Google Citizens Initiative, my name and Paul's name will pop up, and then you go to our websites and you find us. My, you know, the best email for me is my stillman@termlimits.com, but people can reach out. Google me, you'll find me, and, you know, just find one of those email addresses, find one of those phone numbers, and give me a call. And I, you know, if I don't have time to help people, I can definitely point them in the right direction.
What advice do you have for someone who's looking at initiated legislation?
So first, figure out what you want to do. See what somebody else has done so that you've got an example. You don't just, you know, people talk is cheap. Politicians know it. Everybody knows it. Talk is cheap. You got to kind of pencil it out. So figure out, you know, what the problem is that you want to solve. Write it down. Look at other places. Somebody else has probably tackled this. And if somebody hasn't tackled it, then you got a little bit more work to do because you got to frame around it and figure out where you're going with it. And then there's going to be somebody out there who has political leanings your way. They're probably going to agree with it. And if it's a good, solid case, number one, you got to make sure that people are actually going to support this. Mm-hmm. If you can't boil it down to a 10-second pitch that people are going to say, yes, that's a great idea. We need to limit politicians for how much time in office. Yes, that's a great idea. We need to stop the government from taking people's money. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great idea. We need proof when there's an incident with police to defend the police as well as to defend the person who was, you know, police cameras. Yes, that's a good idea. To pass an initiative, it has to be something that most of the people are going to support. So you got to be able to boil it down to that. If it's big and complicated, you're not going to have any luck. Mm-hmm. And once you get it boiled down like that, then go talk to your local legislators. I see a lot of people who just want to take an antagonistic position with their local legislators. But a lot of them, they're not even thinking about your issue. When you go pitch them something that is overwhelmingly popular with people, you might get their help. They might carry it for you. If they won't carry it for you, then at least you'll know what you're up against, and then you can start. And in the process of doing that, normally you'll find some other people who are willing to get involved with it also. So then you go through that process. You know, you got to go to the city council meetings, set some meetings, go to things. Don't go talk to your city administrator. Go talk to some elected officials. Don't go talk to the city administrator or the people who are paid on staff. They have a whole different agenda than the people who are elected. People who are elected, you start talking about things that are overwhelmingly popular with the people, they're going to listen. People who are working there and it's their job, you're talking about adding more work to them. They're not in the business of going out and finding more work. They're in the business of being assigned work. So you need to talk to the people who are doing the assigning. You go through that process, and then you can look. Ballotpedia has a lot of great information on what states have initiative and referendum available at the local level as well as the state level. But you can always reach out to me, and you know, there's people out there who do this kind of stuff. And then you start the process. And you just, but first you have to really boil that down to, is this something that people are going to support? And if you can't boil it down to an easily 10-second pitch that people are going, yeah, I see the need, you're going to have a hard time, because it's going to be complicated to educate people on it, which means you got to spend a lot of money on it. You got to spend a lot of money on the campaign, and it's going to be a lot easier to poke holes in your argument, and you might just be taking on a fight that you can't win no matter what.
I like that, because it all starts with a good idea. Like, you have to have a good idea. Everything else can fall into place to ensure success, but if you don't have the good idea to start with, it's just not going to work. But once you have the good idea, what else do you need?
Once you have the good idea, then you need the legal advice. But before you do that, you want to make sure that you're not going to waste a lot of money on things like expensive legal advice when you can do a lot of that on your own. Because you'll need a little bit of tweaking at the end, because things do have to be in the right format and things. But for the most part, when people look at Washington and they even look at their city council and they look at their state government, it's like, this is really wordy. Why isn't it written like the U.S. Constitution was written 250 years ago, where it's easy to understand, you can read it, and you know what they're talking about? You want to write legislation like that. So you want to go through those steps. Then what do you need? You need to get a group of friends together who are going to go out and gather signatures. If you've got volunteers, you can normally count on each volunteer. So if you had a group of 10 volunteers, you could probably get 500 signatures with that group, because some people are going to go gather 100 and some people are going to go gather two. But normally
the old 80-20 rule. 20% of the people do 80% of the work.
But if you got motivated volunteers and you add up your number, they're probably estimate 50 signatures per person. Then you got to figure out what your signature requirement is, which is all mathematical formulas based on either the number of voters in the district or the number of or in the jurisdiction or the number of people who voted in the last election, which are two different things. And you go through, you figure that out, then you get it drafted up, you figure out what your deadlines are. You might be too late, you know, to start. For the cycle that you're thinking of, you want to make sure that you're not going to end up, if this is a popular issue, which it should be a popular issue, you don't want to end up on a oddball election. You want to be on the November even year election when everybody is there, everybody's showing up. That way you don't have to spend a lot of time turning out people, because you will get opponents, and they otherwise would just be getting passed through the you know, municipal legislature, which is the council or whatever, or the board. So you will have opponents, and those opponents are turning out their people at all those special elections. So you want to be in the general election, and you need to make sure that you have your timing right on that, which can be complicated because there's legal ways for them to delay and push you off and also to jump the gun and move you up. So you do need some advice on that. But once you get that idea, you get it boiled down and get a hold of somebody who's done it before, and we'll talk about, you know, get a hold of me, or I can, you know, put you in touch with somebody if it's not me, and we'll get you in a situation where you can get some good advice on it. And you got to raise some money. If you got a good idea, you should be able to raise some money. And when you're talking about small cities, it's not going to be a lot of money. When you're talking about, you know, a major metropolitan area, it will be considerable.
By the way, and that's for that same reason that you were talking about expanding the house, is that the best way of doing this is knocking on doors, talking with people. That doesn't cost a lot of money if you've got volunteers.
And that's the best politics too, local politics, where people are, you know, involved locally, and we would have a different government if we had, you know, what we started out with at the founding for representation wise. It's a lot harder for lobbyists to wrangle 1,000 people than it is for them to wrangle 435 people. They've got twice as much work to do. So we're adding work to the special interest by increasing the number of elected representatives. And it's a tough argument to make to people that we need more politicians, because people, it's one, you know, when you boil that pitch down, it's a hard one to make and people bristle against it. Mm-hmm. But it really is an important thing. And what term limits actually does is term limits is adding more politicians to the mix. It's just over time. You know, if you take, there's 435 this 2 years, 435 mm-hmm. 2 years from now, 435 the 2 years after that. But we don't actually have whatever that is, 1,300 people, 435 times three. We have, you know, 800 that are there for the whole time. So you might, rather than 1,400 different people, you might have, you know, 600 uniques in that group. But when you add term limits in, you get more uniques in there, and it breaks up that power base, and you get more people representing the people. So they kind of, that's a little bit, you got to think two steps on that one. But, you know, term limits does increase representation over time, because you don't let people hold power over time. And we know that the longer they're in there, the less they represent their constituents, and the more they tend to go and represent special interests. Because that's, you know, it's expensive to be there. It's expensive to stay there.
Mm-hmm. I think you have an interesting perspective, because you've done a lot to shift the Overton window, because you've enacted policies, you've helped local activists enact policies that their elected officials would never touch. But the way that it sounds like you've helped out most is a unique thing, which is you know the right lawyers to connect local activists to. Because that's got to be the hardest thing for a local activist, where it's like, I have a good idea, we've got some interest, we've got a winning issue, I need to get this on the ballot, and I know a lot of lawyers, but none of them are like, there has to be so few lawyers who actually specialize in this area.
There are, and you don't, when it comes to lawyer, you want to get as much of that done. You know, people think, well, I'm going to hire a lawyer. You mm-hmm. hire a lawyer, and you just... You tell them, hey, I need this done. Go do it. They're going to send you big bills every month.
Yes, because it takes them a long time and a lot of research to figure this out. Yeah.
But if you know the right person to hire, and then you know, do this first and then ask them for this, be very specific, you can save and cut down a lot of money. And it's easier for the lawyer, too. It's like if you told your kids, you know, clean up the yard. Mm-hmm. And when I get home, I expect the yard to be cleaned up. And they go out there and they look. That's a big job. But if you say, you know, go out there, mow the grass, and use the weed trimmer. Before you do that, pick up the toys, and you give them a list, and you want these things done in this order, and you're very specific about it, everybody has a much easier time. That job will get done quicker, and it will get done better. You got to be able to direct them. And I know how to direct people and let them know the right things to do when it comes to this, my particular specialty, so I can help you save money and get a better result, and you'll be really doing your lawyer a service, because they won't have to go and reinvent the wheel.
Scott, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window. And for all of our local activist listeners, I hope you learned something valuable to help you shift the Overton window. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.